I'm so glad to be here. I'm so excited about this day long because I think you guys know, Carol. I do remember that retreat we had 2 years ago. It was in that, it's in that very nice place. It has all the windows and it's very nice. Yes, I remember. I don't know if I told you guys this before, but I tend to do one non-residential a year, like one theme. I practice as much as I can the year before, come up with this theme that I want to really talk about, and then I spend the year talking to all these different sanghas all over the country about this theme. And this year's theme is going to be on Nibbana, and I'm so overwhelmed about it. So I want to start with a poem. You know, I'm a poem, I'm just obsessive about it. But this is what I think we're going to try to, this is what I think of Nibbana. It's what I think. Deep inside what I've come to understand and the paradox we're in that we're going to spend the day with. It's from Mary Oliver, and she does have a way of really getting to the point of things. And she calls this poem What We Want. This is what she says about a poem. In a poem, people want something fancy. But even more, they want something inexplicable made plain, easy to swallow, not unlike a suddenly harmonic passage in an otherwise difficult and sometimes dissonant symphony. So, in a poem, just like in Nibbana, in our weekends, in our non-residential, in this whole point of coming to practice all day, people want something fancy. But even more, they or we want something inexplicable made plain, easy to swallow. Not unlike a suddenly harmonic passage in an otherwise difficult and sometimes dissonant symphony. And we want this even if it is only for the moment of hearing it. Even if that's all we get, just that moment when things make sense, it's worth it. That's what I think about Nibbana. And I want to kind of start us out. Want to start us out by showing you a couple of things. I've thought about this and thought about this. Maybe I'll wait. Maybe I'll just see. Maybe I'll start with what you think about Nibbana. This might be a little bit better way to do it. So I want you to tell me, or Nirvana. I like Nibbana, but Nirvana still. What do you think of when you think about Nibbana or Nirvana? What do you think that is? And I'll just take a few of you can just raise your hand. Susan can call on you, and doesn't have to be a long, drawn out statement about it. You don't have to have some scientific understanding. You don't even have to have been awakened and know what Nibbana is. Just what do you think it is? And then we'll talk a little bit about some things I've learned before we start our meditation. So let's see if anybody wants to start by telling us what they think. You can't get it wrong. So that's the first thing we have to do. As soon as you say, tell me what you think it is, everybody's worried about saying the right thing. It's not possible for you to get it wrong because no one on this call is awakened. So no one really knows what the truth is. So whatever anyone thinks thinks it is. That's pretty much what it is.
Thank you, Terry. We've got a couple of hands up. You may also wish to just type it in the chat to Brian, who will read it out for you on your behalf. So, Karen, please go ahead. I've asked you to unmute.
For me, it's just breaking through all my delusions and seeing reality as it really is, whatever the heck that is.
Very nice, though.
And Patrice, go ahead. I've asked you to unmute there. There you go.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Feeling fully embraced, surrounded, involved in love and light.
That's nice.
And Coral, please go ahead.
I think it's where peace is.
Beautiful.
Brian, I think you may have some coming in through the chat.
Yes, I do, Suzanne. We've got Donna in Vancouver says, total freedom from clinging. Rhonda here in Victoria says, clarity, balance, and inner peacefulness. Mm-hmm. Joshua says, cessation, getting off the wheel of suffering. So those are the three I've seen so far.
That's and great.
I think that Sal said sunshine.
Mm-mm. Sunshine. That's very nice. That's very nice. So, you know, I'd like to leave it there. What you guys have said, just nod your head. If you think it's something you could experience now, or is it something, so is it something you experience now? The other side's going to be, is it something that you hope to experience someday, or you might experience in another lifetime if you believe in that? So is this something that you think you could experience now? Let's see who nods their head on that. Raise your hand a little bit there. Is this something that you hope to experience someday in this lifetime? And then is this something that you may not experience this lifetime, but maybe one lifetime in the future you'll experience it? Not too many of that. There's a couple of you. Okay. A second thing, do you think Nibbana, here's the two questions, is it something that you experience it over time, you know, little moments like in Mary Oliver's poem, a moment here and there, several little nibbanas, or is it some big catastrophic, I am awake, this is it, now I'm here, and I've arrived? Which one do you think it is? So how many of you think it's these little short little burst moments that come along the way? It's quite a few hands. How many think it is the burst right out there at the end? I'm finally, that's it. Yeah. I think I'm more in that camp too. Like, boom, I'm here. I also thought that it was something that I would experience hopefully in this lifetime, but more than likely it's going to be a few more lifetimes before I get there. That's where I was of the opinion. When I first started doing all this practicing, I don't know what I believe anymore. I mean, that's a good thing about investigation. I'm less absolute about the whole thing. And my hope is that at the end of this day, if you happen to get enlightened at the end of this day, please let me know. But I'm assuming the closest we could come to is that you have no more absolutes about what you think nirvana is, nirvana or nirvana, but that you are seriously interested in what is this thing that Buddha was talking about. That's what I want you to have. Not, I don't want you to leave the end of the day saying, oh, yes, I know what it is. And yes, I was right. What I thought it was, that's what it is. I don't want that. I want you to be totally confused. I don't know. I thought I knew, but now I don't. But I want to know a little bit more about it. So that's the aim for today. So if we put it in perspective, I want to read you a couple of quotes about what other people have said about Nibbana. Very different than what we said, I assure you. What Mahasi Sayadaw said, he describes Nibbana is said to be the cessation, liberation, non-arising or non-existence of conditioned phenomena. It is also said that Nibbana has no color, form, or size. It cannot be described by using a simile. Because of these points, one might believe that Nibbana is nothing and think that it is the same as the concept of non-existence. But it is absolutely not like the concept of non-existence. It is obvious that it has the nature of cessation, liberation, non-arising, and non-existence of conditioned phenomena. And because this nature is obvious, the phenomena of past and fruition can arise while directly experiencing the cessation of conditioned phenomena. The last thing he says is the cessation of the defilements and aggregates is not a concept of non-existence, but an ultimately and obviously existing unconditioned phenomena. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read this, or in your case, when you hear this, it may sound a long ways from breaking through all my delusions and seeing reality, feeling fully embraced and surrounded by love and light, sunshine, or where peace is. You know, it doesn't sound like that when Sayadaw, when he says it. My thoughts about Nibbana is like yours, you know, very, it just feels glorious. And yet when I read this way of talking about Nibbana, it sounds so stoic. I don't know if you get that same sense. Oh, I'm going to try to read from Analio. He says this a little bit better, but it's still quite stoic. He says, the way I understand it is that in the case of stream entry, it's precisely because of having had the experience of Nibbana, wherein there is no reference point whatsoever for the sense of I am, that the view of self is utterly eradicated. The very certainty of this direct experience makes it impossible to have substantial doubts about the path. Just as one who has touched fire will no longer be able to have any doubts that fire is hot. And from the viewpoint of this direct experience, Nibbana, it becomes also unmistakably clear that moral conduct is an important foundation. But moral observances on their own do not lead to awakening. I don't know. You can tell me what you think, but that doesn't really make my heart leap for joy about Nibbana. When I listen to you guys, sunshine, peace, happiness, all warm and fuzzy embrace, I think, oh, Nibbana, that's what I want to go to. I read some of these great teachers, and I think, Yeah, that's kind of far away. That's somewhere in the distance. I'm not getting there for a while. It's going to take a while. I got more work to do. And that's what I think is the difficulty that we have in the West with teachings of the Buddha. I think we sometimes intellectualize experience in a way that creates a huge separation between the experience and our understanding and knowing of it. That's why we have to practice with it. That's why you have to let go of your thoughts about it and see if you can feel into it. This is what Thanissaro Tenjev said about what the Buddha used in this word Nibbana. He didn't just grab some word. Like we hear Nibbana and it's just a word. Oh, that word represents awakening or liberation, or as we talk about it, being fully embraced and surrounded by sunlight, peace and joy. The Buddha used Nibbana more as an image of freedom. This is an image. So apparently, all Indians at the time saw burning fire as agitated, dependent, and trapped, both clinging and being stuck to its fuel as it burned. So to ignite a fire, one had to seize it. When the fire let go of its fuel, it was freed, released from the agitation, dependence, and entrapment. It was calm and unconfined. This is what I think. This is what I think has become clear, that when Buddha used words, he used the words that the people he was talking to could appreciate that word. And in English, we tend to use words more permanent. It's we talk in nouns rather than verbs. And so when we talk in nouns, I know you've heard me say this before, but the noun part creates this sense that Nibbana is a thing, and I gotta learn what that thing is. This is what it is. And I gotta learn what it is. And we all learn the exact same thing. But what I'm hoping that you will begin to sense into is that Nibbana is a word, a concept for something else, for something that is not readily identifiable. One more thing here. There's a story where, this is after Buddha's death, I think, and there's a teacher that's trying to explain. A king comes to this teacher and says, "Can you please explain this Nibbana? I need you to explain the Nibbana. I hear a lot about it. Can you tell me about it?" And so the teacher says, "No, I can't explain it to you." And he goes, "What are you talking about? If Nibbana is a thing that you guys all talk about, your group of people, you should be able to explain this to me. You know, you should be able to tell me what it is." And the teacher's trying to say, "I can't tell you what it is. It's not explainable. It's not describable." So the king says, "Then it must not exist if you can't describe it, because you talk about it. So you should be able to describe it." So the teacher wanted to give him, help him understand what is meant by something being real and yet undescribable. He asked him, "Is there such a thing as great water, as the great water. He's talking about the ocean. And it's like, yes, there's a great water. Well, what if somebody were to come to you and say, tell me how much water is in the great water, the Atlantic Ocean. Tell me how much water is in that great ocean. And tell me how many living beings are in the great ocean. And of course the king says, well, that's foolishness. I can't tell you how much water is in the great ocean. I can't tell you how much water is in the Atlantic. I can't tell you how many living beings are in there. I know there are living beings in there, but I can't tell you how it is. And the teacher says, so it is with Nibbana. We know it is as it is, but we cannot describe it. But there are qualities that you could point to. And the king goes, oh, well, tell me what the qualities are. You know, at least tell me that. So he says, okay, there's some things, right? The quality of Nibbana is like a lotus flower. You know, the lotus flower, it grows, the lotus grows out of muddy water. But the lotus itself is not polluted by the mud. Because, oh, it's like water that cools and quenches a deep thirst. It's like medicine. When you take it and it alleviates poison. Or it's like the ocean itself. It's very vast and boundless. The ocean has numerous waves in it. So it's like the numerous waves that are within the ocean. Described it as life, as food, the way food supports life. Described it as a mountain peak that is lofty, and yet at the same time, it's completely unmovable. So eventually, this teacher, this king gets the, I think he finally comes to understanding, yeah, there is something to this Nibbana, but it is difficult to explain. So when I asked you, what do you think Nibbana is? What I think you told me is the qualities. Not what Nibbana is, but it has the quality of helping me break through all my delusions and seeing reality, whatever that is. It has the quality of allowing me to feel fully embraced, surrounded by a sense of light and love, or it has the quality of peace, the quality of sunshine, the quality of being totally free from clinging. All of these things that you've described is the quality of that. That's what I think it is that we're looking at. So for today, we want to look at, if this is the quality of it, how do we get there? How do we get there? How do we feel that quality? So before we do our first meditation, I want to share my screen with you so I can give you one more visual, getting one more sense of what it is that we're looking at. And Nibbana, like somebody said, it's this total freedom from clinging. But the Buddha used Nibbana as the quelching of fire. He particularly used fire. And at first I thought, when I first started thinking, I think I should share with you the sutta that made me use Nibbana as a topic. I read this sutta where the Buddha said, this is what the sutta says. Then the Buddha, picking up a little bit of dust with the tip of his fingernail, says to the monks, "What do you think, monks? Which is greater? The little bit of dust I have picked up with the tip of my fingernail, or the great earth?" "The great earth is far greater, Lord." This is what the monks say. "The little bit of dust the Blessed One has picked up with the tip of his fingernail is next to nothing. It's not a 100,000th. This little bit of dust that the Blessed One has picked up with the tip of his fingernail when compared with the great earth." In the same way, monks, for a disciple or a follower of the Noble Ones who is consummate in view, so right view, an individual who has broken through delusion, the suffering and stress that is totally ended and extinguished is far greater. That which remains in the state of having at most 7 remaining lives is next to nothing. It's not 100,000th when compared with the previous mass of suffering. That's how great the benefit is of breaking through to the Dhamma. He didn't say to Nibbana, but breaking through to the Dhamma. That's how great the benefit is of obtaining the Dhamma eye. And that is what I think. This is when I begin to renegotiate on my thoughts about what Nibbana is. And I begin to think it's less of a state of being and more connected to the capacity to see the truth of things, the Dhamma of things. So I'd like to give you an example of what that looks like. I'm going to share my screen, and I'm going to start with this video right here. Oh, share sound, optimize here. So it's just a simple sound. It's not very clear. Can you guys all see that? I'm assuming if you couldn't, you would tell me.
Yes, we can see it.
Okay, great. You see this fire? I want you to take a look at this. I want you to notice how agitated the fire is. I want you to notice how much it moves continuously. And there is much dependence on this, on these logs, this fuel that it's burning. This constant connection. Trying to see if I found a poem. But can you see it? Can you notice how this fire will never stop agitation as long as the fuel is there? It will never stop moving. It will never stop the agitation of it. It is dependent upon this fuel. It is attached to the fuel. It clings to the fuel. And the fuel, the wood itself, and the fire are one. It's one. All right, so I'm going to change this. And I'm going to show you one more. This is when the fire has been cooled. And can you see that it is no danger here? There's no threat here. It's ashes, right? So it seems like there's a little bit of smoldering here. But I'm hoping you can get a sense of the stillness and calmness that is present when fire is put out. When it's been doused with water and it's just ashes now. One more. Well, I guess that was the last one. Do you see that? This is what we're talking about. We will not be able to settle our agitated minds as long as there's fuel for the agitation. As long as we are caught in the fire of that fuel, we will have agitation. It's unwavering. But when I thought about the level of freedom that the Buddha was pointing to, that the dust, the speck of dust, was the level of suffering I would have in comparison to the massive amount of suffering I've had in my life just by coming to an understanding of the Dhamma, just by looking at life through the eyes of Dhamma versus looking at life through the eyes of the grasping mind, that shift was that dramatic in comparison of a speck of dust on the tip of his fingernail versus the entire earth. Now, I think it's worth coming to an understanding how to get to that Dhamma eye. And that's what I think this is all about. That's what I think the whole process into the Third Noble Truth, that's what this is about. So in the afternoon, we're going to talk more about the Third Noble Truth. But this morning, I want us to begin to see, as we sit, how much fuel we are giving to the mind. How much fuel is happening. Not as a punishment or a not liking us. You don't get mad at the fire you saw just because it's clinging to the wood. You're not looking at that fire saying, that wood should be there, but you should not be clinging to it. No. It's clinging to the wood because that's what fire does. The two are inseparable. And we can so easily see that fire and fuel are inseparable, but we cannot see when it comes to us. We somehow or another want to have the fuel, but we don't want the fire, and we want to punish ourselves because of the fire and not do anything about the fuel. That fuel that I think the Buddha is pointing to is greed, hatred, and delusion.